I believe in my powers.
I believe in my powers.
I believe in the powers of my teammates.
I believe in the power of my teammates.
I trust in my powers.
I trust in my powers.
I trust in the powers of my teammates.
I trust in the powers of my teammates.
Somebody get this big walking carpet out of my way.
Look, okay, just get any blunt objects together, all right? Get cornered, bash them in the head. That seems to work out.
Now, what are we, a team? No. We're a chemical mixture that makes chaos.
Gentlemen, I'm Agent Carter. I supervise all operations for this division.
The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
And
angels of love!
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show.
The musician who fell to New Mexico, David Bowie, and the man who fell to Earth.
I'm Sean.
I'm Julia.
I'm Paul.
I'm Rachel.
I'm David.
And we are here for a special episode on a very lovely film called The Man Who Fell to Earth, and for a brief discussion about David Bowie, who at the time of this release will have passed away several weeks ago. So sad news for the science fiction community and for music. But hey, we got another album. That's kind of cool.
Black Star.
Yeah.
That's super cool.
It is really cool. So we're going to start, I think, by just talking briefly about our thoughts about Bowie's career and his influence on genre. As soon as my cat will stop doing whatever that is. I swear to God, get over here.
The kitty want, Sean.
I
kitty
love
want.
You. I love you. Yes, you were adorable. Here, meow to the thing. Come on. Say hello to everybody.
Now he's not going to do it. Because you want him to.
Get off. Jesus, he's over here like rooting around in something, and I know it's on the audio. No, you're not going back in there. Sorry, now I gotta move all this stuff so he just leaves it alone.
There.
Stop it. Go play over there. There are toys. Jesus Christ.
Right, should I count us off again?
What was I saying before my cat? I didn't
even
know.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about David
Bowie's career.
About his career. Okay. Oh my God, he's back. Jesus.
Sean, this is what having children is like.
No, because children you can just lock up in a little room. Chain
you
him
can
to the
do
wall.
That to
definitely
cats
cut this out, too.
I can't do that to a cat. That's animal cruelty.
Oh, because that's not cruel to children.
No, it's totally normal to lock your children in a room.
Oh,
you can even chain them to the wall. I mean, for Christ's sake, people put children on leashes now. Children are literally below animals.
Oh, not now. I was on one in 1968.
Yeah, we had to have a leash for
David
my sister.
David came out perfectly
she was wily.
Fine.
What? Hmm? In 1968, you were on a leash.
They had me. Well, it was like a. It was well, it was kind of a. Like not around my neck. It was a kind
like
of a
little,
halter thing.
Yeah, that a harness was, kind of thing.
Yeah, harness. Yeah. Which my parents were. You got tangled up when the like they were in Paris during the riots of 68, and there was like chaos coming down the street, and they were trying to pick me up in a cafe and get out of town fast. And then my harness was getting all tangled up in the chairs.
Hold on a second. You were in Paris during the student riots of 1968.
Yeah, I got
you
laryngitis
were
from the tear
harness?
Gas. Yeah.
You got laryngitis from tear gas.
What? Yeah. This is crazy.
I have such a boring life compared to all the rest of you. Now David even more than ever. Wow.
What was that about?
It's not like I can really remember
this.
But...
I really want to keep this part. This moment about David's life. I feel like you should be a book.
I think he needs to write like an autobiography at some point. Just
a memoir.
Yeah.
How old were you, David?
Well, I was about a year old. That's May 1968, so I would have been about 14 months.
Okay.
15 months.
So I have a question, David. How many times have you been in the vicinity of some variation of tear gas?
That was the only time, to my knowledge.
Okay, it's affected his memory. We need to talk to everybody in his life. That should be your book. Your book should just be called Tear Gas, a biography
gas.
Of David
yes.
Annandale's life.
Yes, because I was tear gassed when I was a year and a half old.
Explains why you write all those Warhammer novels so
it
bad.
Does. That's right. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Anyway.
So first, we're going to talk a little bit about David Bowie's career and his influence, and just, you know, some parting words about the great Ziggy Stardust. So I will start with you, Julia. What do you have to say?
Well, I've been a fan of David Bowie's music for about as long as I can remember, and I was lucky enough to get to see him in concert in 1997, so that was pretty exciting. He was, at the time, I think, leading up to his 50th birthday celebration concert, so it was pretty awesome. I saw him in Chicago. I got to see him perform a lot of awesome songs live, and he had amazing stage presence and charisma, and that was pretty great. I also think he's a fascinating performer, and I really respect that he had a clear idea of how he wanted to present himself to the rest of the world, and he just kind of made that happen. So we have the thing where Black Star came out, nobody knew he was dying, who wasn't very close to him, and then suddenly it's like he is dead, and then you look back and you're like, oh, Black Star is actually totally a farewell message. And we didn't even realize it. And then there comes out words that he's going to be like releasing other sort of anthologies of previous songs that will be released over the next few years. So we still have more David Bowie to look forward to, which might include things that we haven't heard before, like B-sides and demos and things that we haven't actually heard. So, and I love that he decided, no, I'm going out on my terms. That's awesome. Also, he did the whole androgyny thing, and he did a lot of work for making bisexuality visible, which I think he kind of regretted at some points, but it's also cool because as someone who is bisexual, like, I know how much we get erased.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. What about you, Paul?
Okay, well, I came to David Bowie's music thanks to a lot, like in many ways, my older brother who introduced me to Ziggy Stardust. This was in the early 80s. The actual album came out in the 70s, so it was seminal for my brother, and so he handed it to me because it was science fiction-y, so I thought I'd like it. And I did. And I followed, and then we watched the VCR tape of The Hunger, and then came Labyrinth and Noah's other movie work. I loved him in The Prestige. I thought he was great as Tesla. I kept getting struck at how much Bowie just kept like reinventing himself as a character, as a musician, the kind of music it is. And like every album seems like, okay, I'm going to do something completely different. You can follow me or not. And I really admire that, his chameleon like way to be able to change to what he wanted, not to what everyone else is doing, is what, okay, this is what I'm going to do next. So when his latest album came out, his jazz album, I was like, okay, jazz, that makes sense. He hasn't done that before. And then, of course, then came the news, and it's like, okay, so he wanted to go out on a sad piano note, as it were. And I hadn't heard what Juliet said about some more stuff coming out, so I'm happy for that. So we will still have some more faint echoes of Bowie stuff to come in the months and years ahead.
Fair enough. Rachel, what about you?
So, for me, the actual real import that he had on my life was the fact that he was so androgynous and, you know, sexually ambiguous. I liked his music. I actually was not the world's biggest fan of his music, which, you know, please don't throw rocks at me. But I loved him so much for just being so visibly weird. And the first thing, like, before I actually really knew about his music, the first thing I ever heard and saw him in was Labyrinth. And that really struck me just because of the particular flair he brought to the Goblin King. And, you know, just seeing pictures of him and all the stuff that he did in fashion and the fact that he had this incredibly androgynous look kind of started putting me more down the path of thinking that, oh, you know, this is okay to not have to be one or the other. And then, I mean, there's that famous quote when, what was it? He was at the Grammys. He said, ladies and gentlemen and others. So it's just, you know, he spent so much time challenging the idea of binary gender, and that was just, has been incredibly important to me and still is. And then as an artist, the fact that he just kept reinventing himself and was never like, oh, okay, I found the one, I found the thing that works for me, now I'm just going to do that and rest on my laurels is very inspirational.
All right, and David, what about you?
I'd certainly like to second Paul's comment about his performance as Tesla in The Prestige, which might be my favorite film Bowie moment, because I didn't know he was in the film, and I didn't recognize him. It was only afterwards I realized who that was, and so for, the fact that he just, you know, he disappeared into that role for me, I thought was really quite striking. The music has always been, I guess, peripheral, to my, you know, where I was with music, so I kind of knew of it, but didn't follow it particularly. But I did, there's some stuff in the 90s that I quite liked, and I think for me, that's the most striking musical Bowie moment for me was the use of his song "The Heart's Filthy Lesson" in the closing credits of Seven, because that I thought that song worked so perfectly well with not just the jagged backwards running credits, but that it further undermined the last little bit of imposed hope that the studio had insisted upon in the film. Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman went to bat for David Fincher to keep the ending of that film and not have a last minute rescue. The studio imposed the line that we hear Morgan Freeman saying, Ernest Hemingway wrote, "The world is a fine place and worth fighting for." I agree with the second part, which granted is not very hopeful, but it was something. And then Bowie's song comes on and just totals whatever little sliver we had with that line. And it just, I guess for me, is an instance of how well his music could work with films and be an integral thematic element, even when he hadn't necessarily composed it for that film.
All right, awesome. So my thoughts will be, I mean, some of it's just going to be repetition of what others have said. I agree with you totally, David, that when Paul mentioned The Prestige, I'd completely forgotten it was Bowie, not because of any other reason but the one that you cited, that he just becomes Tesla. He's like this chameleon in that moment. And every time I hear about him in that movie, I have to remind myself, yeah, he was actually in that movie. It's really kind of weird that he just kind of morphed into that creature. Then again, I guess his career, he spent a lot of time becoming other things, as it were. I will say that I was really pleased to see that there's apparently a white giraffe in Tanzania that is being called Ziggy Stardust, because I guess in honor of him, or it may have been named after him before, I'm not sure. I just thought it was funny when I typed in Ziggy Stardust into Google earlier today that was one of the things that came up on the main page, which just is really super adorable. My introduction to his music, honestly, I think it came in 2005, when a friend gave me a CD to listen to, and I really liked it, but I don't think I ever became like an uber Bowie fan in terms of his music, and I think that's just because it wasn't my style at the time. I was into emo rock, so people can yell at me for that later. I do regret, though, that Rachel, that I did not see The Labyrinth when I was a child. I didn't see The Labyrinth until a couple years ago.
Yeah, it feels like it's a different experience when you're an adult and you see it.
It really is. I loved it. I thought the film was wonderful. It was playful and joyous, but I do feel that if I'd seen it as a child when I was like 8 or 9 or something, that experience would be, there'd be something else there that, you know, it's just those things where you missed a film when you were a kid and you just have a different experience. You never recapture that. But of course, he's wonderful in that, and his hair is crazy, and he sings to a baby. I mean, that's just wonderful. So, and I do really appreciate, obviously, his influence, not just on music, but even in genre, right? He was always kind of really comfortable in that world. I also appreciate that a lot of his music had pretty overt political messaging. I mean, he has a whole song about, why he's terrified of Americans, which I thought was wonderful. I mean, yeah. So that's kind of all I wanted to say. I think, more people have more in-depth thoughts because they will have had maybe 20, 30 years of experience with his work than I had. But yeah. So, but we're here also to talk about a movie.
We have to talk about a movie.
We are. It is one of Bowie's probably most famous movies, which is The Man Who Fell to Earth, a science fiction film of sorts that is rather strange and bizarre, and also really fascinating. So, who would like to describe this movie to the listener who has never seen it?
I can describe this movie.
Julia, you now have the honor. Go for it.
Okay, so The Man Who Fell to Earth is a 1976 movie based on a 1963 novel about an alien who crash lands on Earth from his home planet, which is stricken with drought, and his mission is to find a way to ship water back home. So to make this work out, he patents a bunch of alien technology that he knows how it works because he's an alien, but the Earth hasn't gotten yet, and becomes uber rich and uses his money to try to make a spaceship that he can then send water back home with. But of course, becoming uber rich and being a mysterious dude who is also David Bowie, humans are fascinated by him and wonder what is his deal, and eventually discover that he's an alien and capture him and imprison him in a luxury hotel where they ply him with alcohol so he won't leave and will be like biddable and do a bunch of tests on him. And he sort of spirals into alcoholic depression. And along the way, he also has an affair with a hotel receptionist and bellhop and sort of chambermaid who sort of teaches him about sex and church and alcohol, the three things that matter the most to earthlings, apparently. And the trajectory of their relationship is also about as depressing as you would think based on what I've told you about it so far. And in the end, it turns out that everyone on his planet, or at least his family, we see them die, and he does not succeed in his mission. Though he records an album that he hopes will be broadcast there because he doesn't know that they're dead and he hopes that they'll hear it, but they are dead and we know that. And, he's one of the people who was responsible for capturing him meets him and says like, "Hey, sorry, do you hate us?" And he's like, "No, probably if you came to my planet, we'd do the same thing to you." And then he passes out because he's drunk.
Yeah, that's the really tragic story that we had to watch. Yeah, I think that you caught it pretty well, Julia. Good job. I'm gonna clap for you.
Yeah, I couldn't have described that.
Well,
very
done.
Very detailed and to the point. So, given that this is a Shoot the Wiz, that means we all have a topic that we'd like to discuss. There's plenty to discuss for the movie. We probably won't get into everything, but we each have our own little thing. And so, Julie, since you already talked, I'm gonna jump to Paul so you get a little break. And have Paul start with his first thing, which I think is quite apt, given that you would like to talk about cinematography.
Yes, I would like to talk about the cinematography and the look of this movie. The film was directed by Nicholas Roeg, and he is known as being a very cinematography-focused director. I mean, David can probably confirm that he probably did cinematography before he became a director. Is that right, David?
I think so. Is that when you? Because he got to start with Roger Corman, didn't he?
Yeah. I thought so. So he has a very there's a number of very distinct looks to this film. First of all, I'll talk about the setting. The most of the film was filmed within the state of New Mexico. He crashes outside this little town in New Mexico and makes his way and starts building up his fortune and just as soon as he gets rich and powerful enough to do what he wants, he moves right back to New Mexico because it's like and we see it in flashbacks, it's akin to the desert home that he left behind. The desert home was the desert family he has was left in the, was left behind. It looks like White Sands, New Mexico. And we could, it's very almost surreal sort of showing of how alien world is just dying and drying out. It's done in a very almost dark style. It's not as bright as I thought. It's almost like lidded in some ways. And lies as if the candle flame of the planet is drying out. And it's very dark. It's very surreal. It's very moving. The New Mexico landscape that he lives in is beautiful. He builds his house by a beautiful lake, and it's shot really well. The interiors in houses, though, that's where the cinematography takes a 90-degree turn. In comparison to those nice landscapes and the odd use of cinematography there, in houses, it was almost like a handheld feel, some really strange zooms, some really strange angles. He really pushes the camera. I wouldn't say handheld, because handheld wasn't a thing then, but this is a very forced perspective to the cinematography, as he's trying to force people to look at things. We see again and again pushing and shoving and giving it. Nicholas Roeg is definitely pushing us to look at Bowie, look at the character, look at the events in a certain viewpoint. And I found the camera work. I kept watching the camera work to see, okay, what is he going to do next? And I like the interiors, because you never knew what he was going to throw at the viewer. And it's almost make the viewer uncomfortable in some ways about, and to not be comfortable with this alien. So it was almost like an alien viewpoint, I would say. And I really enjoyed it. The look of the film never bored me. So, I mean, sometimes it's like, oh, beautiful scenery, beautiful scene.
Yeah.
This movie always kept my eye on the ball, whether it was doing weird landscapes or weird angles.
Agreed completely, Paul. The first thing I wrote about on Twitter about this film was, my God, is it gorgeous. The opening shots after the crash landing, I mean, I didn't even know it was New Mexico. I had to go look that up, because it didn't look like New Mexico to me. I thought it was maybe California, because it's not. I know. Oh, I know. I'm staying corrected. It's really quite beautiful. The landscapes are just something else. It's really well shot. I did really like, there's a scene where, so like Albert, I think, is the person who's taking care of him, in quotation marks, inside the hotel. We get that wonderful shot of him doing the little cart and sort of picking things up and putting things right as he goes through each of those different rooms.
Yep.
But they're all very different until you get to the room where it's Bowie lying on this giant bed with this massive screen, and he's just there. It's really well done. I thought that too. And I did want to add, to correct the fact that you had, or to actually confirm it, that yes, Nicholas Roeg did begin as a cinematographer before his first directing job. He started directing in 1970 with Performance. His first cinematographer job was in 1960 with Jazz Boat. And I think his first job as working on camera crew was in 1951.
So yeah, it definitely shows that's what he's most interested in, and that's what he goes for.
And I think it really works here, because I think you could have a disaster where you have someone who maybe would not be expected to be good at acting, then given too much to act on, rather than sort of really focusing on a kind of visual landscape. But maybe that's just my perspective.
No, I agree with you. If you had an actor different than Bowie here, I think you would have a really different movie, and maybe not in a good way.
Yeah, I agree there. I think Bowie's perfectly cast. So, David, did you want to jump in with any thoughts on this?
I agree with what Paul was saying there. The visual with Roeg is always very strong. I mean, if you look at even like an earlier film like Mask of the Red Death, just how very, very striking the look is, and which is the one that he shot for Corman. What Paul was mentioning about the flashbacks, I did want to touch on then the elliptical storytelling is also a trademark of Roeg's. So if we look at Bad Timing, which would be his next film, and there he'd have another with another singer in the lead, Art Garfunkel in this case, just before The Man Who Fell to Earth, Don't Look Now, which I think may be the most fully realized of his films that I've seen. So Man Who Fell to Earth is his science fiction film, Don't Look Now is his horror movie. But all of these have this playing around with time, cutting, intercutting, sometimes very, in very unorthodox ways, a sex scene and some other completely unrelated scene, but that are sort of yoked together with violence, as it were. And that is, so the visual, beauty of the films is integral to the visual storytelling of them, because they're rarely like a straightforward linear narrative.
Yeah, by no means. This is all over the place.
Yeah, fair enough. Rachel, got any quick thoughts on this?
Not really.
Okay, all right. Julia, what about you? Got any thoughts on this?
Yeah, the one thing that I didn't hear you guys specifically call out that I really noticed and appreciated was that, especially in the beginning when Thomas Jerome Newton has just fallen to Earth, we see a lot that is kind of from his perspective, and Earth is very alien to him, so the camera is very shaky and focusing on all sorts of weird things, not really sure what to take in and what to make of it. And I thought that was a very cool way to show his alienness.
Yeah, I missed that completely. You're absolutely right. It's like he doesn't know what to do with cars or people, and the camera, like him, is like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what I'm doing here. Yeah, it definitely shows, yeah, he's definitely a stranger in a strange land, even if it's a tiny little town in New Mexico.
Yeah, very much so.
And speaking of that opening, are we to, did the rest of you get the assumption that I did, that the guy we see watching him arrive is therefore another alien?
No, I hadn't really thought that. Seems that
seems possible. I hadn't really put together what the significance there was, but there is a point when Bryce asks him what he's doing, and is he the first one? And he says, visitor, no, there have always been visitors. I've seen evidence of them.
And later on, he's saying, I came alone, nobody saw me. And then we see, and then the camera, we were shown that moment again.
Right.
Of the guy behind, further up, watching him. Whom we never see again, I don't think. So
no.
I'm just assuming another visitor.
That's really interesting. Yeah, you're right. That is one way of really looking at that. Ooh. So what is that visitor doing? Do you think he started an alcohol company?
Well, we don't know where he's from.
He opened Beefeater. That's what he did. Beefeater is prominently placed in this film. Yeah, or who knows? Who knows what he's up to? I mean, he could have just been on vacation, I guess, so. So why don't we then jump to you, Rachel, with your big point that you'd like to bring up.
When I was watching this movie, I remember that when I was quite a bit younger, my parents were like, okay, kid, you need to start watching some black and white movies so we can get you some culture. And I did really well with comedy movies, you know, but then I don't know which of them decided it would be a great idea to kind of like start the foray into serious drama movies with Days of Wine and Roses.
Wow.
Which I am still traumatized by. I was like, oh my God, if alcohol is like the devil. So the entire time I was watching this movie, from the point where Mary Lou gets him to start drinking alcohol, I was just like having these horrible Days of Wine and Roses flashbacks, and I was like, oh God, I know that where this is going. And yeah, that's basically where it went, because there's this very powerful through line in this movie about addiction. And I mean, you can read it more broadly as addiction to a lot of different things, but it's very specifically, you know, addiction to alcohol, where first, you know, he doesn't even want to really drink, and then Mary Lou convinces him to try it, and then he just kind of like goes right down the hill. And at that point, it becomes a means by which he is controlled by other people, and it gets really creepy. Like, there's the scene when they're doing medical experiments on him, and he's trying to be like, no, I don't want you to do this, or please don't hurt me. And they're like, oh, here, kid, have another drink, you know.
Yep.
Here's your anesthetic. And so it's used, you know, he's already someone who's terribly addicted, and then it's used against him as a tool of compliance. And then at the end, he's just basically lost everything. And it can pretty much be traced back to, well, the two factors, one being that human beings are terrible, and the other being that alcohol is really awful. But you also see other strands of addiction in this movie, like his weird relationship with TV, where he watches a whole bunch of TVs all at once and does that to the exclusion of all other things, to the point that Mary Lou has like a screaming breakdown about how he's pretty much ignoring her because he just wants to drink booze and watch TV. many TVs at the same time. And then there's another part where he's sitting there and he's watching all the TVs and he starts screaming at them to get out of his head.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like that, you know, before there was internet, the information overload of having all this imagery just constantly bombarding people. So yeah, it was very much an addiction is bad movie.
Yeah, agreed.
Which is kind of funny because it was David Bowie in it.
Yeah, especially given that, as we talked about off podcast, he has admitted he was on cocaine during the filming of this movie. So it's an interesting parallel. Yeah. Paul, do you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I just want to mention, as far as the television, it's clear that he mentions that television is the way he learned about, people learned about Earth. Because he makes a point about, oh, television doesn't show you everything, which kind of hurt to me. Like, it didn't show you everything you knew about Earth before you got here. And I also was reminded, the whole bank, it's always, I was reminded of an old Taxi episode where Christopher Lloyd's character gets a lot of money, and what he does is he builds a gigantic bank of televisions and he invites all the crew over. And they think this is crazy. What is he doing? And then he has them all on and they start seeing things in the TV that they want. And they all just sit down and start watching the various channels. So when he has that giant bank, it's like, oh God, that's what that Taxi episode referencing. You're referencing this. Okay.
Interesting. Julia, do you have any thoughts here?
I feel like you guys have pretty well covered anything that I would have to say about it. I think the one thing I would say is that, in some ways, watching this reminded me of Lars von Trier movies. And I think that Lars von Trier must be copying, and I think that it was done better before Lars von Trier did it.
Oh, definitely. I can't stand von Trier.
Like, I took a check on Lars von Trier at some point and was like, I don't need to watch any more of his movies. But I remember the first time, the first time I saw one, I was like, oh, this is kind of interesting. And then I realized that they were all kind of like horrible, and that he's horrible to women who refuse to work with him. Like, no woman who's worked with him will ever work with him again.
Except for Charlotte Gainsbourg for some reason.
Yeah, well. But multiple stars of his movies have been like, no, never again. He's horrible to work with and he does not respect women. But I saw a lot of the like seeds of what he was pulling from here. And I was like, huh, this is really interesting that like, this is surprisingly working for me in a way that Lars von Trier movies don't tend to.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the only thing I would throw in here is you mentioned the scene, Rachel, towards the end where they're using alcohol to sort of force him to comply, right? And what they're making him comply is they initially seem like they want to remove his contacts to see the person that's beneath him. And I think at that point, we're supposed to assume that they've been told that he's an alien.
Yeah.
And the horrifying part of that is that they actually x-ray his eyes and fuse his contacts to them. And I read that as very clearly that this is the final moment at which he's had his own alienness removed, that he's made into a human.
Yeah, I read that as the loss of his inhumanity, as it were.
Yeah, and I found that almost more horrific than the previous scene when I see them operating on him, sort of operating. Like they like cut off his nipples. It's a weird operation. It's weirdly sexual, but we'll talk about that later. I was actually really uncomfortable. That was probably the most uncomfortable I've been in that scene, except the other scene I will talk about later. So.
Yeah, so what actually happens in that scene is that they tell him they want to take an x-ray, and he says that he needs to take his contact lenses out because the x-ray is going to be bad, and then they are going to do it for him, and he tries to get the tweezers to do it himself and loses his nerve, and then they like ply him with drinks and try to come at him, and he convinces them not to, and they x-ray him despite his protest after that. So it's like, it seems like they all know that they want to take his contact lenses out, and then they just decide it's too much trouble. They're going to go through the x-ray without worrying about that.
It's horrifying.
See, I wasn't sure. I didn't feel like he even necessarily lost his nerve when he was trying to take the contacts out. I actually read that as he's so freaking drunk at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah, his hand shakes, so that's possible.
Whatever happened, he wasn't able to do it.
But yeah, I mean, I think that if it is that he couldn't do it because he was drinking, that just makes it more tragic because they already did, you know, he did it to himself and then they did it to him some more. And then as a consequence of that, yeah, he's got contact lenses stuck in his eyes forever, which sounds very unpleasant.
Yeah. And there's that really horrific scene later on. I think it's before this actually, where you see just how many bottles of alcohol are in this place. I mean, they're everywhere. I mean, it's very clear that he's just drunk constantly. He's basically killing himself.
Well, it's also interesting because they juxtapose him waking up and having his morning martini brought to him with the scene of the other humans who are like meeting to discuss what's going on with the World Enterprise Corporation and him. And they're going to have drinks. And one of them tells the others, like, you should stop because alcohol is ruining everything that you're doing.
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting all throughout. There are lots of juxtapositions where they do things like that. Like in the beginning, there's a scene where he's in a restaurant eating and there is a sword fight going on. And at the same time, Bryce is having sex with an 18-year-old student. And like, it's all very sex and violence mashed up together.
Yeah, taking my thing.
Well, I'm not taking the whole thing because I feel like you'll have plenty to say about this, but I feel like this is another parallel to alcohol, sex, violence, other things like that are often just juxtaposed. And I'll let you talk all about like the different resonances of that.
There's so much sex in this movie.
But Ed Bryce does actually refer to it as an addiction, doesn't he? Because he talks about his addiction shifts over to the research and it diminishes his addiction for his students. So
somehow legs aren't doing it for him anymore.
That's almost exactly the line he says. I guess that would be a good time to switch to my topic, unless David, you had a thing you wanted to say about the alcohol real quick.
Oh, just quickly that it's amusing that the one thing that his addictions don't do is physically lead to physical degeneration, because you know we get to the end of the film and everyone else is aged 30 years, but he's still exactly where he was,
almost like actual Bowie.
Yes,
who seemed almost not to age. Yeah. So, well, Julia brought up my topic, and I think this is a good time to dive into it, since it is, as Julia was noting, essentially an addiction to, that this film does a lot of really interesting things with sex. So at times it's a bit graphic, but I think the first introduction we get to sex in this film is actually the scene that Julia is mentioning, where we have, our scientist having sex with his students, juxtaposed against these very violent images, And the violent images, of course, is of Bowie's character, Thomas, at a Japanese restaurant watching what appears to be a kind of, fighting artistic demonstration. I'm not sure the exact artistic style.
I think it looked like they were doing like some kabuki or something.
Doesn't kabuki have masks? I can't remember.
No is the thing.
No
that has
masks.
No has masks. No, so it has is kabuki masks. Then. Okay.
Yeah, it is kabuki.
Yeah, and so it's sort of like simulating like a fight in a sort of choreographed dance style with presumably a narrative that we won't get the whole piece. And what I found very fascinating about that scene is the more that you watch it, the more the sex does not seem like enjoyable. It starts actually violent. They're like doing a role play session thing where he's like aggressively, like she aggressively takes him and like fake chokes him with his shirt. And then he aggressively like attacks her and she's giggling, but the giggles almost sound like screams at times. And so this constant back and forth, I mean, very clearly makes a connection between, pleasure and the other side of pleasure, which is sort of the sadistic nature of violence. And that the merging of the two is perhaps one of the more horrifying aspects of this world that he's been shoved into, where we can, in fact, take something so pleasurable and turn it into a sort of masochistic affair, which I think is, becomes very clearly, a problem for him once we realize how sex works for his species, which is apparently very moist.
Yeah.
But it's also very intimate and it is not violent, even though, right, Mary Lou freaks out. Well, she's freaked out before because she realizes he's an alien. And then she like literally pees herself out of terror. But after that, right, she freaks out at the prospect of having sex with him because the idea that it's an alien and that he, like, sex with him is, like, moist and weird. But it's actually really intimate. It's the kind of sex that he's had is not the kind of sex we're shown in this, which is adulterous and violent and complicated in ways that we don't see with what he does as his species. And you see sex all throughout this. I did really like that there's an interracial couple in this movie, even though he turns out to be one of the villains. I really liked that they showed that whole scene and just had, like, the kids, and it was like, no big deal. Like, go on, move on. It's really interesting there too. And then there's just lots of other naked people throughout. Our scientist, I think, has at one point like 4 or 5 different 18-year-old girls. I did find it interesting that there is a lot of penis and vagina in this movie, which I don't think I have seen in a film of this rating in a long time.
It's the 70s, man.
I was going to say, I don't think I've seen this much peen in a movie since Under the Skin, which
was a very hard R.
Yeah, well, and I was going to say, it seems to be like when the presence of the penis is as unsexy as it can possibly be, then it seems to be okay.
Well, to be fair, yeah, that's true. Yeah, because
there was not anything really sexy about any of the peen we saw.
Especially given the line that's associated with it.
You're not like my dad. No!
Yeah, God! You're nothing like my father. And we see that in a few times in succession with different girls.
Different
who
girls.
Say that to him.
Some of whom actually sort of grab, like, his peen. Yeah.
Yeah. And, but it, like, the interesting thing is it's flaccid when that happens.
Yeah.
So it's really showing that, like, this addiction has gotten to the point where it's like, it's not even working for him anymore.
Yeah. God, there's just so much penis.
Which is, I think by 1976, audiences going to a Nicholas Roeg film would have been kind of expecting that. And then more of the same with Bad Timing, which was his follow up to that. And I think the subtitle of that film was A Sexual Obsession. Something like that. Because just before this, there was the legendary sex scene in, Don't Look Now between Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie, which, you know, and to this day, the legends circle around it that, you know, that it was in fact not simulated, or, you know, that's the myth that goes with that particular scene.
That's
so
interesting.
That was almost the if you're seeing a Nicholas Roeg film in 1976, regardless of the topic, you could expect explicit sex and elliptical storytelling.
Interesting.
And we get it.
I will say that I'm actually glad, like, not that, you know, I enjoy, like, watching a movie and seeing penis, but given that there are so many breasts in this movie, it is nice that we at least get some semi-equality in which parts of various genders are shown in this movie. Because so often I feel like nudity, like, you can have breasts, but, like, if you show any, like, vague part of a male genital, it's like that's automatically rated R. I don't know. Maybe I'm weird.
I mean, this is rated R.
It is rated R. I know. You know what I mean, right? Like, so often it's like, oh, you can show a boob, that's okay. But God, my God, you show a penis and, like, whoa, we have to have an argument about whether or not this is too raunchy.
Well, that's kind of, there's always been a thing where more exposure of the female body is acceptable than the male body because patriarchy.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Male gaze.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
We got, you know, not that I'm saying I necessarily wanted to see penis, but I also maybe could have done with less nudity altogether. There's a point at which I was like, okay, like, this is like the 800th crotch shot we've seen now. Like, we could just move on. Thanks. I've seen enough for the day. Well, anyway,
I feel like that's actually kind of the point, though.
That's probably true. Yeah.
I feel like the movie is trying to show you, like, how just kind of horrifying and awful all this sex is, especially to an alien who doesn't do sex that way. And it's part of, you know, the addiction, it's part of the television, the sex, the alcohol, all of it we're supposed to find kind of repulsive by the end of it.
That's fair.
And even from the beginning, honestly, because the first sex scene, it's kind of horrifying. I don't want to actually be watching that.
It's actually really uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah.
I mean, even though you know, like, they're enjoying it, it's...
Yeah. You know that they're consenting and they're apparently having a good time, but it just feels horrifying.
Well, and it's just ethically ghastly, right? I mean, this is preceded by him marking her paper, and toe curlingly awful.
He's like, I just finished marking your paper, and she says, How did I do? And he says, oh, don't worry about it.
And then she strangles him.
Right.
I do think it's interesting it took this long for us to bring that part up, that he's actually banging his students, which is...
His superior doesn't seem to have anything more than finding it mildly distasteful, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
he's like, whatever. Okay, all right. Well, maybe we should jump to David then?
I wanted to, segueing from that, is the whole idea of the fall contained in the title, and underscored, I thought, very nicely when when Rip Torn is looking at the book, and there's the reproduction of Bruegel's Landscape of the Fall of Icarus, and when the image came up, I thought, I wonder if I was thinking of Auden's poem Musée des Beaux-Arts, which then is shown on the next page, and I think that does nicely set up the where the film is going. Though I do wish the first line of the poem had been included, about suffering, they were never wrong, the old masters. And then leading into that description. And that what happens to Bowie's character is like the fate of that Icarus in that painting. Then nobody seeing the tragedy that has befallen, but also he falls to earth literally in the way that he arrives here, but it also seems to be the fall into humanity. So as you were saying, we were talking about earlier how the X-raying of his eyes, sealing his contact lenses on, stealing his alienness, and sort of sealing him in humanity and to be human in this film. I mean, we do seem to be a very fallen species, right? It's an ugly, sordid thing to be a human being. It's hard not to get away. It's hard not to see some angelic aspects to him in his alien form and what he can do in Bowie's presence on the screen. There's a very ethereal quality, to him. And that's all. And so he falls into addiction in insects and alcohol and all the stuff that has been described. And that's part of the kind of ugly materiality, into which he has fallen. So the bright angel has landed in a kind of hell that is our world.
Fascinating. All right. Anyone want to jump in here? Paul?
I do, actually. Because now you're talking about fallen angels and him falling to earth. I'm thinking of the Christian Apocrypha about the Nephilim, the variety of angels that came down to earth to help humanity, and in so doing start falling in love with humanity, start getting all their vices and virtues and basically slipping away from their angelichood by being on earth. And I think this movie has a definite through line of the longer, and because he even mentions at one point he's got to get out of here, he's got to get back home, and he fails in doing that because he knows that the longer he's on earth, the more human he becomes, the more fallen from that angelic presence and angelic state that he started off with goes on. He basically becomes more and more human, and the sealing of the eyes being the final nail in that coffin, that final mark of his transformation to a base humanity from something more ethereal.
Though it's interesting, I mean, at the end of the film, when he basically kind of downplays the idea of the aliens being on a much higher plane by just being like, yeah, we probably would have done that to you too if you'd come to our planet.
That's a fair counterpoint.
Yeah. Which I mean, it is interesting though, and I don't know. Part of me is kind of wondering if he's just saying that to make Bryce feel better.
That's kind of how I viewed it. I thought that was a sort of half-hearted thing. It didn't seem to me that was convincing. But
yeah, I mean, you know, in the poor aliens, all you ever see them do is like
suffer next to that little monorail in the White Sands. It's beautiful, even though it's strangely shot with the strange cinematography. But yeah, it doesn't look like a pleasant place, and they don't really do much. And then when you see them dying off, it's like, oh, my heart just broke. It's like, this is what he left behind. He couldn't get back to save his planet.
Alcohol, yeah, but you know what actually happens family. To them?
No, I'm sorry, Julia, could you jump in again?
Yes, you know what actually happens to them is that they're losing all of their moisture. They eventually dry out and kind of look like they're made of paper bags, and we see them again in Mac and Me.
Oh, well, that just made the movie even darker, Julia.
Yeah, it did.
Fate worse than death.
So you're saying that the man who fell to Earth is from Mars.
They come back and they're looking for David Bowie, but he's already taken a job as the Goblin King in the Labyrinth, and he's nowhere to be found.
Oh my gosh, this is a really cool universe you're inventing, Julia.
mixing and matching Bowie
think about
versus.
It, right?
The Bowie
stories right? About Mars, you know, like when Mars used to be populated, it's because the water's going away, and then they all die off.
See, if only they'd realized they needed to just drink Coca-Cola straight from the ground.
Right? Right?
Oh God, no.
Coke is the food of life.
But on the subject of the whole angelic thing, we really do see him starting out from a pure state where, like, I'm not even clear what's going on with him, but like he's clearly not reacting super well to Earth and Earth technology. Like, he doesn't want to take the elevator, and apparently taking the elevator makes him like pass out and have a nosebleed.
Right.
And it's never really quite explained why or what exactly happened. And it seems like he does acclimate over the course of time. But what happens that night is that Mary Lou comes into his room and is obviously trying to seduce him and drinks like an entire bottle of gin and tries to get him to drink. And the whole time he's just like, no, I would just like some water. And then eventually he's like very gently is like, do you think I could rest now?
It's past 3 in the morning and she's still there.
And like, she's really disappointed because she wanted to get it on with him and have him drink with her, and he doesn't do it. But like, this is clearly like him in his innocent state, and then like she manages to corrupt him. And it's weird because part of the way that she does it is through getting him to go to church with her.
Yes.
Which
yes.
He's really reluctant to do. And then like once he does that, his slide seems to be like in full swing.
Yeah.
That church scene is also a nice little moment, when, you know, I suppose a bit of a wink at the audience. The fact that, you know, we have, a movie with David Bowie in it, and, he's playing a character who can't sing. You know, because of course it's giving away the fact that he doesn't know the words or the tune to Jerusalem means that he's not really English, but we just hear him sort of trying to fumble his way through that. It's quite funny.
I we didn't have a place to put this, but I love that little detail that he says, oh yeah, if I'm in England, I have a passport. It's like, of all the weird things to forge to have as your identity, you don't know if you have an English passport. Like, where did he get it?
TV.
Well, that's the one thing that kind of bothered me through the whole movie was what was with all the wedding rings that he had? And then, you know, at the end, he kind of tries to give the last one to Mary Lou, and she's like, no, I don't want it. And has kind of a...
Yeah, because he's selling them.
Well, it doesn't fit.
Where did
it doesn't
get
fit.
Them?
Well, so, like, my guess is that if they did know everything based on TV, that they saw that on TV, wedding rings can be sold for money in desperate times. Because that's a plot element in a lot of things. So, like, they were like, oh, humans apparently value this weird metal. And if you make it in rings, like, that's cool. So he has, like, a ton of rings engraved with his name so that anytime he goes into a pawn shop, he can tell them, like, oh, my wife gave it to me. It has my initials.
And so yeah, he gets a starter fund.
Yeah, but that first shop says, well, I'm not a pawn shop. You can't buy it back.
Okay, but, that makes sense.
And he's, like, playing a part. And he's sort of like, I understand. And he looks a little resigned. And you're like, sort of like, what's his deal? But then he goes out and he has like a ton of them. And you realize like he's been play acting this whole time. This is what humans are supposed to do. They're supposed to feel sad to sell their wedding ring.
And the funny thing about that is the amount of money he has, he has sold a lot of fucking rings.
Because
remember, he uses this to eventually start a tech company that he uses. He hires the lawyer, so he's got thousands of dollars, right? He's going to pay that guy.
Yeah, because he has $1,000
an hour. He pays him $10,000 so that he can have 10 hours of his time at $1,000 an hour.
So assuming he got $20 for every single ring, which is how much he's paid at the one place we see, right? Like that's a fuck ton of rings. Where does he keep them?
He might get better deals at other places.
Possibly. Hey,
that's the first
And that's some of the nice shorthand of the film, right? It just gives us a brief glimpse of, okay, here's how he did that. And, you know, the precise details of how that all worked, we don't need to know. So it's just this nice little moment of, you know, here's this, you know, this like several dozen rings he suddenly pulls out of his pocket. And it's like, oh, okay, that's
how he's doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Speaking of falling, though, in that theme, there's another scene with a man falling to Earth.
Oh, yes.
That is where his patent lawyer gets tossed out of a high window and falls to his death.
Keep in mind, he gets tossed into the window twice because the first time doesn't break it. And his response is, I'm sorry.
Yes, I know. This horribly black humored moment there.
Well, he knows, like, it's like he knows from the beginning that if he does this, if he takes this on, he's basically, like, selling out and he's doing something that will eventually catch up with him and go wrong. So when it happens, it's like he's panicking, but he also expected that this day would come.
Yeah.
But what is that corporate organization that...
That's the government.
Is it? I couldn't figure out what the heck, who they're supposed to be, because they show up, They put on
Sparko disco helmets.
Yeah, motorcycle helmets for some reason, which I was really confused by.
Not just like any motorcycle helmets. They're like sparkly glitter helmets.
They've got the 70s. Wrong ones when they start.
It's the 70s. Yeah. All they need is a disco tune. They're good. No,
it's the Disco Boys.
Yeah, it's the Disco Boys. What they are is the physical embodiment of the evils of capitalism. Clearly.
There are some things in this movie that are not terribly well explained, and I feel like that's one of them. And I also don't really understand why they throw the other guy's barbell out after him.
See, I thought I really honestly thought that what we were going to get is a really bloody death where they were wearing those helmets with the visor so they didn't get blood in their face. Right?
Yeah.
Which I thought would have been cool. And then, like, they beat him, and then while he's beaten, then they throw him out the window. But no, that's not what we got. It seemed like they wore them so that he couldn't see their faces, but you could see their faces. So,
yeah, maybe they were wearing them to protect their eyes from any glass that might fly back at them.
I guess, but that's not how physics works.
There wasn't really a lot of logic to that scene. I feel like that scene especially has the hallmark of something that someone really high thought was a good idea.
Possibly David Bowie.
I don't think
David Bowie was the only person doing cocaine during the production of this film.
Oh, I'm just going to throw that out there. To be fair, I think everyone making movies that were sci-fi based in the 70s were on something.
Well, we know that too for Zardoz anyway.
Yeah.
And I think the bit with the barbell, I mean, that was a bit of metonymy, showing us the death of the other guy too.
The lover.
That part actually worked for me. And just when we had all the stuff that was going to take apart that corporation, I guess I read that as unnamed government agency, whose purpose is to maintain status quo, which this corporation is wrecking, because it's flooding the market with unbelievably advanced technology.
Yeah, some of which was like the camera that we see in the first sex scene, where like the whole time that they're having their loud, weird sex, she's taking pictures. And then in the end, she's like, do you want to see them? And she pulls out a roll of color film that is in there that like has already been developed.
Yeah, it's like
that
super
was a nice
Kodak.
Little bit of anticipating digital cameras there, didn't it?
Yeah.
And you only
get one copy of each picture, it looks like.
Yeah. And the weird little balls they use for music.
Yeah. They're just little things that are subtle with what the technology that's being presented, which I really enjoyed.
But it's definitely definitely alien, definitely supposed to be this is how he's making his fortune, clearly.
Yeah. Okay, so we gotta jump to Julia, because Julia, I left you last on purpose because you were gonna talk about the main man.
I was going to talk about David Bowie. And yeah. I mean, the reason why I said that I'd be happy to talk about David Bowie in this movie is because this is his first starring role in any movie. And it is kind of astounding how much of this movie works because David Bowie is the main character. I think that like it helps that it's really well paced and well edited, and it has some interesting cinematography, and it's sort of like, even though it's a very slow movie, it doesn't get boring. It sort of, things are happening the whole time. There's not a good place for you to kind of like check out. But all of that is good. I think that if David Bowie had not been the main character and you'd had some other random person in that role, I don't know that the whole movie would have worked, because he is so strange and compelling. And he's sort of like, the first time Mary Lou is talking to him, she tells him, you know, "You're too thin, sir. I think you need to eat more." And we see his body in quite a lot of detail. We don't actually ever see his penis, I don't think.
But yeah, we do.
Briefly, we do.
Briefly. Very briefly. Briefly. Yeah.
When did we see that?
It's in one of their sex capades where they're like running around, and we just get a flash of a penis.
Like a tiny flash of it.
Well, yeah. I was going to say, it's toward the end when, after all the stirring martinis with guns and.
When he's like shooting
blanks at her.
Yeah, okay.
You get like a full frontal shot.
But the camera lingers a lot on other parts of his body, though. So we see a lot of his legs, of his sort of pelvis and his shoulder blades. And he's really gangly. He's really skinny. He's also, like, his teeth are not straight. His eyes are different colors. He looks so weird. And it's kind of inconceivable how someone who has this combination of obviously not perfect body parts is so attractive, but he's ridiculously attractive. And it seems like everybody who encounters him kind of like feels the same way, whether or not they want to have sex with him. They're just compelled to look at him, and you believe that he is this strange, mysterious man that people want to know more about. And the fact that he is like private about his life totally flips them out, because he's weird and they want to know what makes him tick. And he does it so well. It's partly the way he carries himself. It's partly the way he speaks. He does a really good job with his role. And even though he's high the whole time, like, somehow it works for him. Unlike Carrie Fisher in the Star Wars Holiday Special.
I like Carrie Fisher.
I do like her in that, though.
But it really does sort of like carry through a lot of the things that we associate with David Bowie for the rest of his career. The sort of like giant amount of charisma and ethereal otherness, and the androgyny is there. It's sort of the ambiguity around the sex that he's going to have or not have. And everything that he does is his own thing, which is really, really interesting. And I think fascinating, especially when like you look at the close up of his face when he's kind of looking in the mirror at the point where he's going to take his contacts out and tell Mary Lou everything. And we see his face in the mirror, and then we see a close-up of his face in the shaving mirror. So we're looking at his face two ways. And that is like a super compelling, arresting image, and also drives home the fact that he looked the same until he died.
Yeah. Yeah. So I completely agree that I don't think you could have had somebody else in the role. I just don't think this film works without David Bowie as Thomas. I don't feel like David Bowie's actually acting all that much in this movie. I feel like he's just being David Bowie. And I mean that like, it's just something, he has like this weird
alien magnetism to himself, right? He just kind of is this being who almost feels alien, even though we know he's not. And I think one of the weird ironies of this film is that, strangely, the most enjoyable human character in the entire movie isn't actually any of the actual humans. Like, almost every human in this movie is a villain in some capacity, or at least they're capable of villainous things. Whereas it's this alien who is kind of pure and has to be utterly destroyed by all of humanity. And I think there's just Bowie, for some reason, that it's just his personality fits here for some strange reason. It's just a Bowie thing. He may actually have been an alien. I don't know.
So that's... Yeah, I think it's interesting that you're like, that we know he's not an alien. And I'm like, well, do we know that?
I have no idea.
I'm not actually clear that we have any solid proof one way or the other on that.
If he was an alien, I mean, kudos to his planet of people, because the guy was talented, tell you that. All right, Rachel, what about you? Any thoughts on Bowie in this movie?
I feel like everything I could say has already been covered.
Fair enough. All right.
I know is particularly useless, but Julia covered anything that I would have said extremely thoroughly.
All right. Fair enough. Paul, what about you?
I second everything Julia said. I just want to reconfirm that, yeah, this was the template that he used going forward as far as movie roles. I mean, that otherworldly alien. I mean, this is the pure 100% hit of it. I mean, in The Hunger, he's playing a vampire, and The Prestige, he's playing a weird inventor. He's got a couple other bit parts here and there, but this is, and of course there's Labyrinth where he's playing the Goblin King, but this is the unfiltered Bowie as not human movie experience. It's almost essential in a way to understand those other roles, see this, and then like everything else makes sense.
I will say that if David Bowie in The Man Who Fell to Earth played Edward Cullen in Twilight, I would understand a lot more what Bella is attracted to.
Yes.
Because, like, if you just imagine that, like, all the words are the same, the script is the same, but it's David Bowie from The Man Who Fell to Earth playing, like, everything he says is automatically 10 billion times more, like, weird and otherworldly and compelling. Sexy.
Oh, see, yeah. I was going to say, I think if we were going to insert a David Bowie into Twilight, if you made it like Jareth David Bowie,
no,
then all the creepiness would make sense and it would be actually like sexy instead of just creepy.
But see, the thing I like about the David Bowie from The Man Who Fell to Earth in that role is that like the weird alien purity thing is there. And I think Twilight banks a lot on that.
Yeah. I would go one step further and I would just make all the male characters in the Twilight movie David Bowie.
Just different David Bowie.
Bella's dad, David Bowie. Jacob taking his shirt off, David Bowie.
I'm now seeing a mashup of being John Malkovich, being David so Bowie.
Right?
Bowie.
Somebody needs to make the fan edit of Twilight where they replace all the Twilight male characters with David Bowies from different David Bowie movies.
I would willingly see that movie in theaters. I would pay money. I would pay $25 a ticket to go see David Bowie in Twilight.
Yeah.
You all know you would. You would pay to see that.
It was my idea.
Yeah, like, Julia would. And she's going to get directing credit or producer credit or whatever. Yeah, it's going to happen. The thing is, in like 10 years, I bet you they'll be able to do it with computers.
Oh, but see,
10
the
years,
same.
They could do it now.
I know they could, but they're not going Wait, to.
But then it would be
stupid.
Like Uncanny Valley David Bowie, they're, and that's just...
They're getting towards that. I'm kind of reminded of the Robin White movie, The Congress.
Yes.
Have you seen it? Mm. Yeah.
Yep.
You do that with David Bowie, it's like, put Dave Bowie into anything.
That was another movie that was kind of weird.
Oh, God, yes.
Okay, well, let's save it because we may have to do that movie sometime. So we should then jump to final thoughts and a grade for this movie, which may be very difficult to do, but we're going to have to do it anyway.
And we'll start with you, Julia, with your final thoughts about the movie and your grade.
This movie is very clearly in the same vein as Zardoz in being a mid-70s science fiction movie that really wants to be art and is doing weird, weird things with sex and violence. It's also nominated for a Hugo that year and does not win because nothing wins that year. That year's slate is Zardoz, The Man Who Fell to Earth, Carrie, and Future World, and no winner is selected.
Oh, wow.
Which I think is fascinating since Carrie and Zardoz and The Man Who Fell to Earth are all like pretty like interesting movies that are clearly
Oh,
what is your theory, David?
My theory is that what we see there, especially when we look at things like this and Carrie, is that this is a collective fit of pique over not being allowed to vote for Star Wars, which isn't eligible until the following year. And so, because he knows instead Star Wars gets this ridiculous made-up Hugo, and all these other films are denied one.
Yeah, like Star Wars gets a special award, even though it shouldn't be eligible for a Hugo until the next year. Yeah, well, we've talked about that before. I think we've talked about how like we think the Hugo votership was probably really down on the depressing science fiction movie, and this is another one of them. It's very artsy, it's full of sex, and it's very depressing. And Star Wars is like the total opposite of that. It's a fun adventure that does not have a lot of penis in it.
No.
I'm pretty sure that Star Wars has zero penis. I mean,
no, it's all metaphorical.
George Lucas might have added one with CGI. I wasn't looking too carefully.
No, if you think about the X-Wings as being penises shooting their sperm balls into a giant space planet
Sean,
vagina.
Sean, if your penis has S-foils that can be put in attack position... I don't want to go anywhere near you, and I am afraid for any girlfriend you might have.
This conversation has gone to a very uncomfortable place.
So we're not going to talk about weapons that activated growing long, and then... okay.
No.
Are made of pure light that if they touch you will cut you.
Yeah. For heaven's sake, Mel Brooks had the right of it, right? When he
no, he totally
did. Schwartz is bigger than mine.
Oh, dear God.
Let's see how you handle it. Yeah, okay. Julia, get back to your final thoughts.
So anyway, I find it very fascinating that this is like kind of the situation with the Hugo nominations and the dramatic presentation for 1976. And I guess actually for 1977, because it's all movies that came out in 76. And I find it fascinating that this is clearly another one of them. And I think that this one, I will say with great confidence, actually succeeds better than Zardoz at doing what it's trying to do. It's slow, but it's never boring. It's well-paced. It's got interesting stuff going on. And all of the messages that it's trying to drive home actually go. Zardoz kind of gets bogged down in a lot of places, and it's not always clear. It's a lot of times kind of muddy. But yeah, that said, I feel like between that and the fact that David Bowie is so compelling to watch, I would have to give this movie probably a B+.
All right. Excellent. All right, Paul, what about you? Final thoughts and your grade.
Okay, final thoughts. Yep, this is definitely a movie that, as Julia said, succeeds better than Czar does and what it's trying to do. It's slow, it's sedate, but it's not ever boring. We're arrested by the imagery. We're arrested by Bowie. We keep the tellingly, when the movie moves away from him, like for interior scenes, it doesn't work quite so well. But the whatever we have, the cinematography outside, or we have Bowie on the screen, which is for most of the movie. The movie just goes and you just sink into this world, and into poor Thomas Jerome Newton's played as he falls to earth, and it's visually arresting. And I think I had seen pieces of this before. I had not seen the entire movie before, and I'm very glad I did. It's kind of hard to grade, though, because it's kind of sui generis. You have a director who's really a cinematographer at heart. You have David Bowie being David Bowie. I'm just going to throw a dart at the board, and I think I'm going to come up with the same thing Julia did and come up with the B+.
Awesome. All right. Rachel, what about you?
Well, this movie was certainly a trip. I'm not sure if it was a good one, as in like a good trip versus a bad trip. I mean, I don't regret having watched it. I would say that I can't praise it as effusively as others. It was interesting, but I kind of wish I'd had an extra beer before I watched it, because I think that might have helped.
Oh no, that's the path to just
Did you learn nothing? And then the next thing you know, I'll have like an entire wall of different TV screens.
I hear Addison helps.
No, I agree with you, Rachel. Like that's why I give it a B+, and I can't bring myself to give it an A, is that I don't know if I ever want to see this movie again.
It was deeply unpleasant to watch. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I don't either. But I don't regret watching it. But yeah.
And for me, like, well, I mean that this, you know, I've had reactions like this to other movies where I'm like, it was really good. It made me feel things. It made me super uncomfortable. It's right up there with The Revenant for, it's really good. You couldn't pay me enough to watch it again. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's an important part of Bowie's legacy, and I'm never going to watch this movie again, so I'm going to give it a B.
That's fair. I mean, you can include that as part of your criteria. I think that's perfectly valid. So, awesome. All right. David, what do you do for this movie?
Well, this was actually my second time, but the first time was many, many years ago. There are a lot of things that I like about it. It isn't Rogue's best, and I think, if you look at, comparing this to Don't Look Now, which is a masterpiece, and all of the things he's doing with oblique storytelling and the sex and the build up to this just unbelievably chilling finale. This film isn't reaching the heights of its predecessor. And particularly, I found the writing for, Candy Clark's Mary Lou character was, quite painful. Bowie's presence is magnificent. There's all kinds of really interesting ideas that are at work there. And it is, I guess, in keeping with a lot of other, sort of pre-1977, science fiction films that are really engaging seriously with the ideas that that they want to present. I guess I'm going to go with a B on this one.
All right, fair enough. So my final thoughts, I'm honestly kind of agreeing with a lot of what others have said. So the short of it is, I find this film very fascinating. I don't know if it's a film I could rewatch a lot, although I would watch it again as a scholar, because I kind of want to write about this movie because it's crazy and could be a lot of fun. So I would also give it a B because of how interesting it is as a movie. And for what Paul talked about, which is the cinematography is just freaking gorgeous. And if you just watch the first 5 minutes, I think you'll get a sense of how beautiful this film is. Although you should maybe watch the whole movie at least once. So, all right. So that's it, guys. We did it.
We did it. We averaged out to a B and a, we averaged out between a B and B plus. Two B pluses, two Bs is B half plus.
It's a B and B two and a thirds.
Awesome. Awesome. So if you'd like to let us know your thoughts about this movie, you can go to skiffyandfanny.com. You can go on the little sidebar. You'll see episode 42 for Shoot the Wizards on the little side there. You can go straight there, leave a comment there. You can also send us an email, skiffyandfanny@gmail.com. You can also yell at us on Twitter. We're at skiffyandfanty. And where else are we? We have a Facebook page, and we also have a Google Plus page. No, we don't. No, we don't. Don't go to Google Plus. Nobody goes there anymore. It's like LinkedIn.
I would like to add you to my professional network on Google Plus.
I swear to God, if the other thing to mention is you can support us on Patreon by going to patreon.com/skiffyandfanty and support us at any level you feel comfortable. $1, $7 million, anything you want. If you happen to have $7 million to spare and want to give it to us, I will be retiring immediately and becoming a professional podcaster. So then again, probably half of the people on this crew will not join me because they've got other jobs.
Unfortunately,
so,
yeah.
Yeah. So, thanks, guys. You guys are awesome for coming in, talking about this movie, and for recording one of my four podcasts for the week.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
All right, guys. On that note, awkward ending. And scene. Our intro and outro music comes from Nocturnia by Psychedelic Pedestrian. You can find out more about them on freemusicarchive.org, including the full version of the song. We obviously made some edits to the song, including sound effects and, of course, shortening the length. You can also support us by going to patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. If you'd like to send us a suggestion, you can do so at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com. You can also go to our website, skiffyandfanty.com, and check out the little suggested topic form at the top there. You can also just send us emails. You can also find us on Twitter at skiffyandfanty or on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Just search for us on there. Thanks for listening, and we hope to see you next time.